So, as we have seen, the strike came to an abrupt close. Blandin's new policy was simple and to the point. No member of the International Papermakers Union would henceforth be employed by the Itasca Paper Company, and no further agreements of any kind would be made with the organization. Well, a week after that strike had started, the Herald Review reported that for a town supposed to be in the grip of an industrial strike, Grand Rapids is particularly quiet, with no evidence of trouble of any kind. Many strikers, though, must have regretted their action, for all the jobs left unfilled by the strike were taken as numerous local applicants arrived at the mill to take advantage of the situation. Non-union members and new workers crossed the picket line with impunity. The non-union skilled workers repaired and adjusted the Fourgeneer, while Blandin recruited experienced papermakers and technicians from paper districts with unemployment. As the new employees arrived in numbers, a housing crisis in Grand Rapids was met by construction of a camp on the grounds of the paper mill. There, some 80 men were temporarily housed and fed. Just 10 days after the strike was called, paper production was again underway. Blandin commented, "So far as we are concerned, the strike amounted to only a slight interruption to business. We have filled without difficulty the places of the men who went out on strike and have a permanent crew again." The union strikers continued in picketing for a time, but they'd lost their bargaining power. And some of them then resorted to more drastic action. When four recently hired workers left the mill at the end of the shift at 11 o'clock, they realized they were being followed. A group of 20 or 30 strikers stopped and surrounded their car and then threatened them with bodily harm if they did not resign from their positions at the mill. The employees reported the incident to authorities, providing the names of six of the would-be assailants. All from Grand Rapids, the six were quickly bound over to await grand jury investigation. Both the Herald Review and the Independent carefully avoided editorial comment throughout the period of labor unrest, but their news stories indicate that there was little community sympathy for the strikers. Blandin reiterated that any striker was welcome to renounce union affiliation and reapply for work at the mill when openings existed, but he also stated, "Account will be taken of the attitude and behavior of former employees since the strike. The company cannot be expected to view with favor any interference with present workers at the mill, nor any attempts to intimidate those who are trying to provide a livelihood for themselves." Also taking still stronger action, Blandin called on his St. Paul attorney, W.H. Oppenheimer, to use legal means to prevent further threats of violence by the strikers. To maintain contact with his employees, Blandin introduced a system whereby the various departments elected representatives to meet with company management at designated times or as needed, to present grievances or other special matters. While holding the strongest hand in labor negotiations during the period after the strike, Blandin and his managerial staff still made every effort to be fair and to keep employees content. Holiday receptions, free movies, and company support for recreational activities continued, and to allow time for family travel or gatherings, the mill shut down for several days at Christmas and the 4th of July. The camp remained to accommodate those who had come from elsewhere to obtain work at the paper company. A visitor described a 30-cent meal there as a well-cooked, hearty repast of roast beef, several kinds of pies, and many extras. And because housing in Grand Rapids continued in short supply, the company built a number of homes that were then rented to employees. More important to employee welfare, the company strongly emphasized the need for improved safety conditions at the mill. After a two-month period in which there were 12 serious accidents, the company launched an intensive lasting safety awareness program. It promised that every device and safety appliance that is practical will be added to the mill machinery to ward off injury, and emphasized employee education and full participation in the effort. During the first month of the campaign, only 3 minor mishaps were reported. A life and disability insurance program provided a major new benefit for employees of the mill. In an editorial titled "A Benefit to All," the Herald Review agreed that the insurance plan was a progressive step in industrial and social life in Grand Rapids. The newspaper also echoed Blandin's thoughts in regard to labor, commenting that the benefit program aided in cementing a bond that cannot be shaken by professional agitators. The editorial concluded that the employees would grow to have a greater appreciation for the efforts of the paper company in their behalf. After breaking the strike, Charles Blandin retained an attitude of rigid antipathy towards nationally organized labor unions, and he never wavered in his staunch opposition to what he felt they represented. Years later, one of his employees remembered, "There were some things that Mr. Blandin believed very strongly. He always wanted and expected a good day's work, and he was very anti-union. Oh, just mention the word union, and he would bristle and his eyes would snap." Blandin had no use for the AFL, remembered a mill executive. "Boy, he was very firm that he would lock the door and throw the key in the Mississippi if that happened. Anytime there was any smell of union organizing going on around Grand Rapids, he was after you to do something about it." Blandin and Greenway certainly share in common strong antipathy towards labor unions. As the strike was broken, another factor of major importance was taking place at the paper company. Improvements at the mill during the early years of Blandin's presidency had resulted in rising production for the Itasca Paper Company. During the last fiscal year of their management, the Kaukauna owners of the mill produced 7,800 tons of newsprint. By 1920, 4 years after the purchase of the company, Blandin had reached his initial goal of an annual output of 10,000 tons. But although much had been accomplished in improving the efficiency of the mill, any sizable production increase would require more than rebuilding and raising speed of the existing Ford Dernier. The Kaukauna owners had never been able to afford another paper machine, but Blandin, constantly requiring more newsprint for the expanding St. Paul papers, soon realized the need for a second machine. In 1920, he wanted to order a Ford Dernier, but because the United States industrial production was still not fully geared to a civilian economy after World War I, he would have had a 2-year wait for delivery. Deciding to take a temporary measure, he arranged to buy a used Black Clausen machine in Cambridge, Massachusetts. The number 2 machine was installed adjacent to the original Ford Dernier. Although the machine was smaller than that Beloit Ford Dernier, the Grand Rapids papermakers expected to increase production by 50%. So finally, they are managing to raise the paper production rates at the company. And most of all, all of this activity in that new machine was a clear indication to those in Grand Rapids that no, this paper company was not on the way out and it wasn't going to go under, as had been feared just a few years before.